and it's 6 past the hour here on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition. Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor. Good morning to all. We are not here, are we, Riley?
Not here.
Not here, but we're here in spirit. But today we're hosting Randy Rhoads' show this afternoon. We're looking forward to that. We're hopefully going to get ourselves out into the world with a bunch of people that don't listen to us in the morning.
Yeah, I mean, these are afternoon people. They're big Randy fans. Randy's got a lot of fans, and we're going to entertain them for the first time.
Yeah, it's like we're usually in the morning drive time. Now we're in the afternoon.
Yeah.
So we're hoping we can say, hey, how are you, afternoon drivers? What are you doing tomorrow morning? Yeah, or Monday morning. Maybe you should like us.
Yeah, I mean, if you're not busy.
We do have a lot of great stuff on this show, though. For people who listen to our show regularly, you know, maybe you've missed some of this. If you never listened to our show, or if you're just coming in for the first time, we got Ken Burns. We're going to give you a little taste of Ken Burns.
Yeah.
He's on promoting his
Unforgivable Blackness.
That was incredible.
Yeah,
I don't know if it's still running on PBS, but it's available. Mike Doty, one of our favorite musical guests, the ex-frontman of Soul Coughing, is a fascinating and amazing singer-songwriter.
Yes,
in his own right, and he was what was most of Soul Coughing anyways, and he's going to be playing a couple of tunes.
You know, I've been listening to his stuff, too.
Have you really?
Yeah.
We've got the Best of the Liberal Confessional. That's going to be on the show today. And Terry Jones of Monty Python.
Oh, yeah, that was fun.
But right now, first, we've got an interview with a regular guest, Art Spiegelman, comic artist, creator of Mouse, and In the Shadow of No Towers. This is his newest book. You can see his work regularly in The New Yorker. We had a conversation with him about post-election America and how comic art can help us get through it all.
You spend some time in Europe. Your wife was born in Europe.
Yeah.
And you have a place over there?
Yeah.
Now it seems to me that there's a couple of I know a comic. I know that Crumb is in Europe. Do you guys all hang out over there?
Yeah. Actually, I see Crumb every year.
Oh, yeah?
Really?
And Gilbert Shelton, the guy who did the Furry Freak Brothers, is...
Oh, really? He's there, too?
...happily enfolded in Paris, yeah.
So is there a little...
Well, there's a lot of cartoonists. I mean, I'm hanging out with a lot of Italian cartoonists who have emigrated from Italy because it's not as pleasant an environment as... You can still smoke in France.
Sure.
But
don't you?
It's required, yeah.
Have they banned smoking in the rest of Europe?
No, in Italy. They just got through it in Italy today.
Really?
Yeah, the Italians are really miffed.
It seems like, especially with Italy and France, that the cigarette is like a permanent detachment.
Yeah, they graft them in at the age of 12. It's sort of a confirmation ceremony, you know. But in Italy, they passed this law that just went into effect yesterday, and everybody's grumbling and talking about rebelling, but I'm sure they'll kowtow the same way the Irish did, you know, which I didn't believe was possible. You can't imagine going to a pub and not smelling smoke.
It's still hard for me to deal with in New York, but
yeah, I'll say.
Yeah, right.
And I don't smoke anymore, but mm-hmm. I work in clubs, and just the idea that I don't walk out of a club, you know, smelling like cigarettes and stuff, there's part of me that's sort of nostalgic about that. I don't mind smoking. I miss cigarettes.
It's definitely a fuel for good conversation. Like, I find that hanging out in a cafe in Paris is still a genuine pleasure, even if I didn't smoke. And the idea that I can actually smoke and talk at the same time and not be, like, confined under house arrest in my studio is amazing.
You're making me a little itchy now. I feel the Jones coming back.
But, like, in Paris, it's coming even to Paris. There's beginning to be, you know, mumbling about, like, curtailing smoking, which was part of my conversation with the French, because they're very happy with me. My No Towers book went over a lot easier in Europe than it did here.
Like, sure.
In France, it was just sort of embraced. I was just seen as an underweight Michael Moore or something, you know. But,
right.
But in America, although it sold very well, there's a lot of controversy about the takes in The Shadow of No Towers. But in France, where they're very proud of it.
Specifically?
I mean, I'd have to, like, pull out all the reviews, but they were, like, really angry, nasty reviews. I didn't have the right attitude towards September 11th because I didn't get real sanctimonious about all of the dead, as if I didn't care about it as an event. You know,
right.
I was just using it as an excuse for a polemic rather than the actuality, which is I was horrified by the event and then saw the event being dragged into becoming a political...
But isn't it interesting that personal reflections, that, you know, you were being honest about your feelings and your artwork, and they criticized you for not towing the party line of what they thought you should be feeling along with the country?
Yeah, you know, instead of, like, talking about, like, the poor firemen who lost their lives, I was just, like, totally narcissistically engaged in my own private life in the shadow of No Towers.
Well, some people were.
And that private life ended up like being interrupted in its grieving by the shenanigans of Giuliani and
sure.
Bush and beyond. So I was forced into becoming a kind of political cartoonist, even though it's not my predisposition.
Yeah, what would you call your predisposition now, a cartoonist?
Narcissism.
I got a question for Art.
Yeah.
I got a question about the creative process.
Mm-hmm.
Which comes first, the artwork or the dialogue?
Well, for me, usually the writing comes first, but it's not always that way. Like in that new page that I just showed you, there's one image that made the rest of the page happen.
In the New Yorker.
Yeah, the back page of the New Yorker. The first panel is a picture of Uncle Sam wearing a crucifix, which I was just doodling in my notebook. And then at some point I drew right next to him myself in a T-shirt that says, "I'm with Stupid." You know? And that was like just a single image. It wasn't like a comic strip per se.
Now, you were in your studio when you
of
did
course,
that?
Yeah.
Were you on the
yeah.
train or what?
Oh, I don't remember because it's all one work.
Of course
basically.
They love you in Europe.
I got a free pass. I get to go back. They'll pay me $200,000 a page to bash Bush. It's all under the table. It's perfect.
But look,
wow. Right here in the center of the page, you have an ark, like Noah's Ark.
Yes.
Only it's for people now. Like, see, it's got a sepia flavor to it. It's got a sepia tone to it. It's got some sort of glorious kind of a shot here. Now, when you do something like that in the midst of what is not a standard comic strip, but certainly a different style in the other panels, I mean, what are you drawing from there? I mean,
there, I'm literally drawing with a paste pot from a Gustave Doré Bible illustration of Noah's Ark.
What's a paste pot?
Oh, you know, just paste it in.
You know, oh, really? You just cut it out?
It's just clip and paste. That panel was the easiest one I had.
Here I'm sitting here thinking, like, wow.
Man, that's a lot of lines.
Spiegelman's really done it.
No,
hell of a
but
job
I gave him
with
credit.
Bulk,
I gave,
you know?
To be fair, unlike Williams is trying to, like, keep his collaborators out of the spot.
Oh, yeah, it says right there.
You know, it's like me and Gustave Doré did that page.
Yeah, 1866. I'm sure he's very happy.
I'm sending him his part of the show.
Okay.
We'll be right back with more from our interview with Art Spiegelman, and we've got Ken Burns coming up. You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition.
Just to wake up.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
I've heard about those people.
On Air America Radio.
Thanks.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Yo.
We're listening to our interview with comic artist Art Spiegelman with you, and he's about to dish a little bit about Bush. I haven't talked to you since the election, before we were leading up to the election, but you were pretty pessimistic then, as I recall.
I was, although I cheered up for the 48 hours leading into it. I just bought into all of the punditry and went, oh, we're winning.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And then, like, ever since whatever it was, like 1 a.m. of that November somber night, you know, I've just been bummed out.
Yeah, and did you go away?
I was on this book tour that was more like a series of stump speeches, political actions, than like promoting a book per se.
Oh, really?
Like going to campuses and talking to people. And,
now, do you draw? Good draw? You get a good crowd?
Yeah, I do, except I don't seem to meet any Republicans no matter what state I go to, which is what makes me think this is all some kind of science fiction plot, you know, like pretending that there are Republicans out there where there's only about 8, you know.
Able to vote like 40 million or
yeah,
like 10 million apiece.
Yeah, and all of their ancestors get to vote, too.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
So, on the other hand, like, yeah, I was in all these red states, but I kept meeting fellow Americans.
Now, when you bring kids, like when college kids come up to you, do they have you sign mouths? Do they know your work?
Comics have become rock and roll on campus.
It's true, right?
Yeah.
I just bought our producer Quetzal Larson. I brought him Chris Ware's giant book, The Quimby the Mouse Thing.
Oh yeah.
Are you a fan of that guy?
I love Chris's work. In fact, I think I was probably the first person to publish him when we were doing Raw.
Is that true?
Yeah, he was a shy kid. Now he's a shy 30-plus-year-old. But he's in college, and I got to see his stuff because somebody sent me an article about my work from a college newspaper from Austin.
Yeah.
And the article sucked. But on the back, there was a little piece of a comic strip by Chris. And I'm like, this guy's good for Raw. So I called up to get his address. And he certainly knew Raw, but he didn't think he was ready for prime time. So he took a lot of coaxing to get him to give us something.
Well, he's a very meticulous guy, and I think you shared that quality. I'm looking at the back page of the New Yorker right now, and it's amazing about your work is that you draw from all different styles of art and photography and history, and it's hard to pinpoint your style, per se.
Yeah, I think of style as something, for myself at least, as it was like a corporate trademark, and I don't have one.
That's good.
Know?
So that's it's good. Like, you can do anything.
Well, I can't do anything, but the result is that I'll do anything, you know, like, because yeah. I can't. So basically, it's a matter of, like, finding what visuals feel appropriate for the matter at hand. Like, that No Towers book is just sort of, looking back on it, it's a collage of about 15 different artists, or mainly the work of one very schizophrenic artist.
You know, yeah. In that book, you have some actual strips, old strips, like antique strips.
Yeah, the
like,
second half of the book was all, I thought of the book as these two towers. Like the first one was my experiences the morning of September 11th
yeah.
and the what I've come to call the hijacking of the hijacking that took place shortly thereafter,
right.
reducing the event to a war recruiting poster. And then I didn't intend to make a book, and when I was making it into a book, my idea was I have to have a happy ending, and there's no happy endings in the 21st century, so I'm going to climb back to the beginning of the 20th and start over. And I began to find the old comics that were made just for that day's news cycle and meant to disappear that still were vibrating and beautiful the way art is supposed to be.
Yeah.
So I found pages that seemed to reflect on the contemporary moment from a moment 100 years earlier.
Oh, that's wild. Vibrating as art is supposed to be. That's pretty good. That's exactly what art does. It vibrates. That's how you know if something has artistic integrity on some level.
It's got to be built to last. It's got to keep vibrating inside your head after you've read it. And a lot of this stuff, like I said, it was just made to be fish wrapped right
yeah.
after. But it's still, you look at those little Nemo Sunday pages from 1906 and, man, they're as good as anything any of the so-called high artists were making around them.
Let's take a call for Art Spiegelman. Annie in New Jersey. How are you, Annie?
Hey, Annie.
Hey. Hi, how you doing?
Good.
Just wanted to say, Mr. Spiegelman, I really love your art. It's made a real difference in my life, and I love the fact that you take the discussion to a different level, a more visceral level, and it's more comprehensible for a lot of people. I'm a knit designer. I'm a knit teacher. They teach all over the place, and I, no matter what reaction people have to your comics, I find that it makes them have a reaction. You know, they just can't be Walmartized, sanitized, non-thinking, go along with it. It makes them at least think, and I think it's a brilliant thing to get people to open the dialogue. You know, all of your work, I really enjoy it very much.
Thank you. Like, I know that like comics are getting used in schools a lot more often because at least it looks like reading.
Yeah.
Thank you for your call, Annie.
Thanks, Annie.
Well, that's interesting about, like, you know, what you were saying is that, you know, when you have a dialogue of narcissism, which I have as well, and I think, you know, Crumb, I think, shares that with you, too, is that you're constantly, you know, seeing everything in relation to you. So there's a constant dialogue of funneling through you between, like, that, just looking at that, looking at this, look at that. And it is a really, I think, a very honest, it's a very provocative way to do comics.
Well, the advantage to it is at least you know where somebody's coming from.
Yeah.
You know, like when somebody's like this guy Williams you were talking about earlier in the hour, like he's not letting you know where he's coming from. So
right.
Like, the result is it's this phony objectivity that
right.
Is part of like that allows the dialogues to take place in public like torture, pro and con, you know, because you've got to present both sides of that issue.
Yeah.
And it's more realistic to like indicate where you're coming from, saying, yes, I'm a sadist, and I love the idea of like draping prisoners in Israeli flags. Or whatever they're doing now.
Right. There's an honesty to it. I agree with that. Let's talk to Joseph in Michigan. Joseph? Yeah.
It's a cliche question, but I'm dying to ask Mr. Spiegelman, what advice would you offer to the aspiring graphic novelist?
There you go. Thank you for your
advice. Right. Thanks for the call.
I would say work very fast, because right now there's a bandwagon and every publisher is jumping on it. By next year, the wheels will have snapped off this particular bandwagon.
What, the graphic novel?
Yeah, it's all... I mean, every publisher is coming out with comics now, and we're in the delusion, because the only books that are really selling these days in bookstores are so-called graphic novels and religious books, you know, so... If you can come up with a graphic novel about religion in the next 3 months, you've got a publisher. You know? But I guess my main advice has always been, like, keep your day job, because it's one of those things where comics is not an easy way to eke out a living. It's us flukes that have managed it.
You know? I got to be honest with you. I have learned, like I said before, I learned a lot from that guy who wrote about Bosnia, the graphic novel.
Oh, Joe Sacco. He's brilliant.
He's great.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't know about... I had no real sense of the history of what went on in that region. And from reading Safe Zone...
Safe Zone Garage Dive.
Yeah, yeah. It, from reading that, it just blew my mind. I mean, it was an effective way for me to learn.
He's the only comics artist I know that has a journalism degree. So, like, he's very scrupulous as he runs around and does this. And the only problem is, see... one of the reasons you can't make a living as a graphic novelist is it's such slow, tedious work. You know, you got to draw everything over and over again. And so the result is he's a journalist, and he's doing stuff about the occupied territories and former Yugoslavia, and I think he's just came back from Africa and is working on something about that. But you're so slow that you can't deal with the daily news cycle. Mm-hmm. So you've got to, like, come out with your news report about 2 years or 3 years late at a minimum.
Right.
And so you've got to, like, really sink your teeth into what you're reporting on. You know?
Right.
Like, and it gives it a kind of urgency. You know, like, when you get your news report about Yugoslavia from a video camera that functions like a vacuum cleaner, sucking this stuff in and then spewing it out, nobody ever has to look at it except maybe the video editor before putting the news clip out. Here, every building is witnessed, you
right?
know? And like that, witnessing itself is an important part of his reportage,
right? And because it is in that graphic form, it'll never get old. It'll never get, like, even though it's reporting, which you're saying, I think on some level is disposable. This stuff is going
to... It makes it not disposable.
Exactly.
It says, like, this is like our particular example of man's inhumanity to man right now, and that's going to remain true,
right? So now, quickly, you know, well, we got a minute. What do you think is accounting for this tremendous, you know, wave of popularity?
I've been trying to figure it out. It's possible that it's just like this McLuhan-esque thing where, like, when a medium stops being a mass medium, then it's got to reinvent itself as art or die. And now we're watching comics reinvent themselves, get themselves into museum shows, libraries, bookstores in a big way, get commented on and reviewed in the press that used to reserve its space for literary novels and so on. And I think that that's partially just a seismic shift. Part of it may be just that, you know, I've heard it said that in a fast culture where people get their information visually, people are just trained to be able to suck in the information the way comics offers it.
All right, thanks for coming. So, Mark Riley, you know, it's funny with Spiegelman is that underneath anything he was saying was the deep desire to smoke.
Yeah,
Spiegelman. Every time he's here, he's got to go out in the hallway and smoke. The guy loves the cigarettes. It's his breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
The back staircase will never be the same.
That's right. So we got Ken Burns coming up. It's 27 past the hour. This is Air America Radio. Welcome back. It's 34 past the hour. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Yes, it is.
We're hosting Randy Rhoads' show this afternoon. That's why we're not here. But we did talk to Ken Burns about his film about Jack Johnson. It's called Unforgivable Blackness, The Rise and Fall of Jack Johnson. It aired on PBS and is now available on DVD, and it's very worthwhile. It's a great film.
And here's our conversation with Ken Burns.
Let's talk about Jack Johnson. The first time I became introduced to him was in a Bud Schulberg book about Muhammad Ali. I can't even remember the name of the book, but I was fascinated with him when I first read about him. Can you tell us a bit about his place in the world?
Absolutely. Jack Johnson was the first African-American heavyweight champion of the world. He won the title first in 1908 after many years of pursuing several champions literally around the world, begging for a chance. But in those days of Jim Crow America, he wasn't given a chance. There was not an unspoken, but just a written rule that African-Americans couldn't fight for the highest title. In those days, the heavyweight champion had huge symbolic and metaphoric meaning. And at the time of imperialism by the Western European and American cultures around the world of white man's burden, to have a black man possibly having a chance to win the heavyweight title was too big a risk to take. But in 1908, Jack Johnson was able finally to get a chance that promoter offered the current champion, Tommy Burns, no relation, enough money to fight him. And then Sydney, Australia, on the day after Christmas, Boxing Day 1908, he just demolished Tommy Burns. The celebrity journalist Jack London, who was a socialist but whose sympathies for the working man did not extend to people of color, was there and said, we have to find somebody, a white hope, who can wipe the golden smile off Jack Johnson's face. Jack Johnson lived his life out loud in an age when African Americans were expected to defer to whites and everything. He wore the finest clothes, drove the fastest cars, hung out, took lovers of both sexes. And so this period came up looking for a great white hope that would finally beat him, and he just took on all comers and beat them the ex-champion Jim Jeffries, who had retired undefeated, rather than fight Jack Johnson, came out of retirement to fight him. Jack Johnson demolished him, and race riots broke out. The kind of race riots we would not see around the country until Dr. King, whose birthday we celebrate, whose life we celebrate today, would come along. And this was white-on-black violence, whites going into black neighborhoods, furious that their man, Jim Jeffries, had lost. And when our country could not beat Jack Johnson in the ring, they went after him for his personal life.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, now, you didn't mean to say took lovers of both sexes, did you?
Well, yes, I did, and that's exactly what
happened. He was bisexual?
No, both colors.
Exactly. Oh, both races. But when you said both sexes, I said, whoa, hold up.
Yeah, I was right there with you, Ryan. I was just sort of like, well, that's cool. It's early in the morning.
Yeah,
both sexes, both races.
This guy was both races.
That was something, man. Driving the cars. So now it's interesting because a lot of this, I think, this type of reaction towards black celebrity still exists in some parts of this country.
It is the echoes of Jack Johnson are almost everywhere. You can see it in Kobe. You can see it in O.J. You can see it in Terrell Owens. You think for a moment if the woman who jumped into Terrell Owens' arms had been an African-American woman, there'd been a fuss. Do you think if Kobe's accuser had been African-American, it would be even a story? If O.J.'s ex-wife had been African-American? So we have this. Look, Jack Johnson engages all these themes central to America. It's outsized personalities, which we pretend to like. It's about athletic accomplishment. He was the best and the first, and there are those who still believe he was still the greatest of all times. This is about race. Our title is Unforgivable Blackness after a comment from W.E.B. Du Bois, who said that this was not about character when the country went after him, because other boxers and ballplayers and even statesmen had the kind of off-stage dramas in their personal life that Jack Johnson had. It all came down then, he said, to his unforgivable blackness. This is also about sex. This country is almost equally hypocritical about sex as it is about race. And when that sex is between a black man and a white woman, oh, my God, get under the desk until the storm blows over. And in the end, we discovered this was a story about freedom.
You know, it's interesting. I did not know a lot about Jack Johnson as a kid because my family didn't discuss him that much. You know, everybody was kind of fixated on Joe Louis, who, of course, came along, what, 20-some-odd years after Jack Johnson?
22 years after Jack Johnson lost the title, Joe Louis won
the title. So, you know, Jack Johnson I learned about as a teenager, and particularly with the emergence of Muhammad Ali. And you talk in the film a bit about the similarities between the two men.
Yeah, there's huge similarities, but let's just bring up three. Muhammad Ali fought with a distinctive defensive style. Mm-hmm. The rope-a-dope is the way we sort of distill it today. That's all from Jack Johnson.
Yeah.
Jack Johnson was the pioneer. He'd followed a white guy named Gentleman Jim Corbett. But it was Johnson who had perfected this style. It was much more intelligent, cerebral, elegant, balletic, as opposed to the kind of brawling style that so many boxers adopted.
And he was in jail with a boxer who helped him
as a kid, really. He had fought a round with a guy named Joe Chunsky, and the Texas Rangers had come in and broken up the fight and had taken them both off to jail. And in jail, Chowinski, this old fighter, had taught him the finer points of this defense.
Now, why was he taken to jail?
Well, boxing was a largely illicit enterprise almost everywhere in America, so he was going to do that. Muhammad Ali also had this brash public persona. He didn't invent this out of nothing. And in the dark night of Muhammad Ali's soul, when his own government was against him, he must have taken some comfort from the fact that he was experiencing this in a decade we now consider dedicated to civil rights, whereas 50 years before, Jack Johnson was suffering even worse at the hands of his own government in a decade, I can assure you, was not dedicated to civil rights. In fact, more African Americans were lynched in the first two decades of the 20th century than in any other 20-year period in our entire history.
Okay, if you want to hear Ken Burns say bling bling, keep listening because we'll be back with our interview with Ken Burns. This is Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition on the air. Online. MorningSedition.com. Air America Radio.
We're back. I'm
Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hi.
Buddy, we're hosting Randy Rhoads, the show, this afternoon.
That's going to be fun.
It is. And right now, we are sort of ghost hosting our own show. We're listening to Ken Burns, and we're talking to him about the about Jack Johnson, one of the great boxers of all time. Ken Burns' documentary, Unforgivable Blackness, is available on DVD. And I'll tell you, the first time I saw that, one of the things I noticed about Jack Johnson is that timeless. The dude, like, you know, his build is completely timeless.
He was completely buff, and he fought an extremely, and I mean extremely smart, strategic fight. I mean, all of his major fights, he had a strategy that worked, and Muhammad Ali used later on.
Well, let's hear Ken Burns tell us a little bit more about Jack Johnson.
We're talking about the life of Jack Johnson, and essentially his freedom and his, I guess it is a type of courage to live as large as he did at the time he did in as public a way. Do you think some of it had to do with being a role model? What is his legacy in the black world?
It's interesting. He was not a, quote, credit to his race. He was a loose cannon on the deck of the racial politics of the time. Booker T. Washington, incredibly disturbed by him, said a man with brains, a man with muscle minus brains is a useless creature. Even W.E.B. Du Bois, who defended Johnson's stuff, was uncomfortable with his choice of profession and lifestyle. He was a free guy. You know, he came from Galveston, Texas. And Galveston, like New Orleans, was one of those places that was a little bit Jim Crow's grip was a little bit less. It was integrated. It was the coast, got all these influences. Jazz would be created in New Orleans. Jack Johnson was created in Galveston, Texas. But the ultimate question is two things that almost are unanswerable. The failure of biography, filmed or otherwise, is that two, how did this guy not get killed doing this? And one, how did this kid from Galveston, Texas, have the courage to swim upstream against the current of the universe? And you know what? Our view of this period is the Jim Crow South and the Ku Klux Klan corner. These are the enemies. You know who the enemies are? It's the New York Times. And the Daily News, and the Detroit News, and the Los Angeles Times, who referred to him regularly with the N-word, called him the Dinge, the Big Ethiopian, the Big Smoke. The Los Angeles Times, after he beat Jeffries, printed an editorial that said, "A word to the black man, do not raise your nose too high. Do not puff your chest too much. You are the same lowly creature you always were. Don't get too excited just because somebody of your complexion just won the heavyweight championship." Mm. The New York Times referred to him as an animal.
Wow.
The New York Times. Oh, yeah. So we are talking about the entire force of the universe arrayed against this man who invokes the most powerful word there is in the face of oppression. No.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to dress the way I want to. You want me to just cross to the other side of the street. I'm going to drive the fastest cars. I'm going to sleep with whoever I want. And, in fact, that's his undoing, because when our government can't beat him in the ring, they take the Mann Act, intended to regulate commercial vice, and apply it for the very first time against an individual. Never intended to regulate personal morality, but Jack Johnson's sex life is what they can get him on, and they convict him in a quick trial. He's sentenced to a year and a day in jail. He escapes to exile for several years. When he's finally defeated, overage, undertrained, overweight, the door slams to African Americans, and the next champion that's African-American is going to have to be the anti-Jack Johnson, light-skinned, where Jack Johnson was dark-skinned, agreeing never to celebrate his victories, and Jack Johnson had a winning, big, toothy grin, agreeing never to be photographed with a white woman, never to be photographed in a nightclub. Jack Johnson owned a nightclub. Jack Johnson married white women, and that man was Joe Louis. And it was going to set a stage for what the responsible African-American was going to do. It's epitomized, of course, by Jackie Robinson, who's going to bring the kind of Christian biblical forbearance against all the racial threats and slights and abuse that he would face for the three first years of his major league career. It's only until Muhammad Ali, who's going to reach back across the decades, leapfrog Jackie Robinson and Joe Louis, and find in Jack Johnson the model of a new Negro to go forward as, you know, with a kind of defiance and with great intelligence. You know, the conventional wisdom, the received wisdom, is that Jack Johnson was some animalistic oaf who couldn't contain his appetite.
Oh, absolutely.
The real Jack Johnson was intelligent, articulate, smart, owns 3 patents with the United States government for the design of wrenches to fix the cars that he liked to drive. I mean, this man is history running on all cylinders of one of those fast cars.
Wow.
You know, when you look at his life and you look at the fact that, that he knew going in that his sex life was going to come back to bite him, come back to hurt him, fired not one but 2 managers who urged some caution in how
he
conducted
was getting uppity.
Yeah, and said that he was getting uppity. Why do you think it was that he ignored this? He consciously ignored this. I mean, he said at one point, and I guess maybe this is the best explanation, you know, I do what I do because I'm an American.
Today we celebrate the life of the Reverend Martin Luther King. Martin Luther King didn't get where he got because he was accepting the norms. He swam upstream as well. And I think American history constantly kicks out to us people that are different, people that remind us of our possibilities. You know, during the American Revolution, Bill O'Reilly would have been a Tory siding with King George. You know?
Yeah.
He forgets that if he lived in Iran, he'd be a mullah,
uh-huh.
Right?
Yeah.
But Jack Johnson was willing to see the things as they were. He wasn't going to be a race man in the sense that, that Booker T. Washington wanted to, or even W.E.B. Du Bois. He was not just ahead of his time, he was outside of his time. He said, I am going to be who I am. Of course, he was his own worst enemy. That's going to get you into trouble. And we see that kind of bad behavior today as sort of being, you shrug your shoulders and go, yeah, pull down your pants in the end zone. You know, come on. So the hard thing is for us to put our arms completely around all the complexity of Jack Johnson. But in the end, he's a testament to courage, to forbearance, and what bravery really does when you say that powerful word, no.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's funny. If he had been born in 1978 instead of 1878, he would have led a very different life because he'd have been in his mid-20s now. And in 2004, a lot of what he did is not not particularly it's looked at in some quarters, but certainly not by the larger.
Well, you know, he's the original player.
I mean,
if you think about it, if you take him out of his context of his time, he's got the bling bling, he's got the long coats, he's got the fancy suits, he's got the fast cars, the entourage, multiracial entourage, and the fancy cribs, you know? Yeah. But the thing is, today, it's a kind of transparent manner. What are you risking today with that? Nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Jack Johnson risked everything doing that. And that's, to me, what the difference is. And the intersection of race and sex, politics, power, athleticism. This is a beautiful man. I mean, an amazingly modern person. You look at the pictures of him, and he seems almost as if he's been photoshopped into these old photographs, and everybody else with their, you know, tight Victorian collars are there. But Jack Johnson, we know. He's the only person, and I've been doing this for 30 years, who you could pick up and bring into this present time, and he wouldn't have a nervous breakdown the way Thomas Jefferson would. He'd be on. He'd be the sexiest man alive. He'd be on Entertainment Tonight. People would be talking about his exploits, good and bad. He'd be a bad boy. But he, at his time, could remind us that, A, not all African Americans think alike. Right? Because the diversity of opinion, black ministers and black newspapers went after him, but a huge mass of ordinary people saw in his example the possibility that they could, that the door had been opened just a little bit,
Do you find that with people like Jack Johnson, that, you know, all this, the talk of why, you know, he was able to live like this is that he wasn't asking himself that kind of question. He was like, you know, I've made these decisions. This is my life. And that's it. It wasn't sort of like, should I do this? Should I not do this? He doesn't think I should do this. There's no self-consciousness there.
He's one of these people that you see today without risk. He was saying, look, I think the best way to handle race prejudice is to pretend if race prejudice didn't exist
at all.
And that's those are his words exactly. And he went on in the face of the New York Times, in the face of the LA Times, doing that. I mean, now, 100 years later, we can sort of begin to sort it out and understand this period was terrifying. I mean, it really was. It was
a scary, scary time.
Those lynchings,
to be black in America.
Exactly. Those lynchings happen more often than not because a black man looks sideways at a white woman.
Right.
And here you have a black man who's openly taking white lovers. I mean, it's in the newspapers. The photographs are there. And you think about this, the newspapers went insane.
I got to ask you a question, though. And this is kind of in the context of the total body of your work. Why do you think it was that Jack Johnson, in a book that he wrote that didn't sell particularly well, hold forth against jazz, which you also profiled?
Well, that his autobiography was so self-serving that it was ridiculous. I mean, he told people to eat more fruits and vegetables. He said
that's a good idea.
That women shouldn't go into nightclubs. I mean, that he'd always treat women with respect. That he'd thrown the fight that he'd lost. I mean, it was a self-serving thing, and we tend to ignore it.
It was even later in his career. Was it an apology?
Much
27.
He was trying to rehabilitate because he was on the fringes, kept out of the boxing world he loved so much. Look, race in America is there from the beginning. We're founded under this remarkable creed from Thomas Jefferson that says we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. Yet he owned more than 200 human beings as he wrote those words, never saw fit in his lifetime to free them, never saw the hypocrisy, never saw the contradiction, and set in motion an American narrative that is both bedeviled but also ennobled by a question of race. And when you get to know Jack Johnson, the complicated hero that he was, and heroes aren't perfect, they're just negotiating their strengths and their weaknesses, the Greeks have told us, you in the end find somebody that carries this story of race along and, I believe, ennobles it in the end.
That was Ken Burns in an interview we did with him during the PBS run of his documentary, Unforgivable Blackness, The Rise and Fall of Jack Johnson, which is now available on DVD. It was amazing, Riley, when I'm watching that, I was uncomfortable because you see that how long ago it was just by the nature of the film, and you see, you know, that he's, you know, has all these, a couple of white women with him, and I'm thinking to myself, that guy's going to get his ass kicked.
Well, there were many, many people who wanted to see him die over that. That was why, for example, they didn't show a lot of the footage of him boxing, because he was the antithesis of what America had stereotyped black people to be. And he made no bones about it. He made no apologies for it. And I think he knew at a point in his life that the choices he made would doom him later on in life.
We got the liberal confessional coming up next, the best of the liberal confessional. That's where if you have a transgression against a progressive ideology, you call and confess your sins to Brother Riley and myself, and we will give you some penance. We also will be looking at the difference between insurgents and freedom fighters. And that's about the little thing about language we had with some of our listeners over the email. It's now 57 past the hour. This is Air America Radio. Good morning, people. It's 6 past the hour. Mark Maron here on Morning's Edition, Air America Radio with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
So excited about this, Riley. We're going to host Randy Rhoads' show this afternoon.
Yeah.
And now, this morning, we're going to bring you some of the best moments from the past few months of Morning's Edition, like we got Mike Doty's live performance. You like him.
I love Mike Doty.
And our liberal confessional calls, we got some of those, which are this is all going to be in this hour. But first, I want to listen to a discussion we had on the show. It was about whether or not we should be calling armed fighters in Iraq insurgents. We got into a pretty heated conversation. Here's what happened.
Got some issues here. You know, certainly the reason that we went to war, if you want to consider yourself part of the collective, or the reason that the neocon death cult put us into a war situation, was based on a lie. All right, there's a lot of things. All of the war is on some level bad. Okay, but watching Iraqis the other night, even after talking to Mick Ware, I mean, they have not had a vote in that country for how long? Over 50 years?
Yeah.
Okay. Tyranny, you know, just, you know, a horrendous situation in Saddam Hussein for a long time. Now, it breaks my heart to even think that maybe, you know, any of this could be traced to George Bush in terms of if anything good happens out of this. Obviously, you know, it was, if they are successful in creating some sort of functioning democracy there, mm-hmm. the Iraqis, and if we do pull out, it's a good thing if that happens.
Yeah.
Without a doubt.
No doubt.
Okay. Now, I got this email yesterday, or the day before yesterday, that just stuck in my craw immediately. I had to parse it out myself. I had to think about it. I had to, you know, figure out why I got so upset. In honor of George Lakoff, you should be the first liberal talking head. Again, not a good name to call people. Talking head is not a compliment, but anyways. You should be the first liberal talking head to stop calling the Iraqis fighting against the U.S. insurgents. In World War II, they would have been called freedom fighters or the resistance. Stop using the right's language to make them seem less than what they are. Well, I don't really think that insurgent is the right's language. I think that the way they use the word terrorist is the right's language. That the, you know, the way they blanketly, you know, they call everyone a terrorist who does anything anywhere that blows up. Everyone's a terrorist.
They called Nelson Mandela a terrorist
right.
for the longest time.
But insurgent, this is just a word that, you know, the definition fits the situation. But there is something about the word freedom fighter that connotes a certain, you know, there's a romanticization, a romanticizing, a mythologizing of a resistance movement when you call it, you know, a freedom fighter. You know, that's a noble thing, the freedom fighter. Now, I'm going to try and reframe a story that came out yesterday using this woman's language. I'm going to take her request and reframe a story that we got yesterday. Okay. Now, I'll just take it. It's an AP story. Okay. It came off the newswire. Now, here was the story. All right. Terrorist used a disabled child as a suicide bomber on Election Day. Iraq Interior Minister Fala al-Nakib said yesterday, in all, 44 people were killed in a total of 38 bomb attacks on polling stations. Police at the scene of one, the Baghdad blast, said the bomber appeared to have Down syndrome. Okay, so the bomber appeared to have Down syndrome. So now, let's just reframe it using the suggestion of our emailer. Freedom fighters used a child with Down syndrome as a suicide bomber on Election Day. Okay, end quote, end reframing. Freedom fighters used a child with Down syndrome, okay, to blow himself up. Hey, go over there. See where the people are? They're candy. They'll give you candy. Yes, go over there. Okay, put this on. Okay, all right. So that's a freedom fighter. Then I get a email yesterday. All right, now, let me give you this. The definition of the word insurgent, rising in revolt against established authority, especially a government, rebelling against the leadership of a political party. Here's another a member of an irregular armed force that fights a stronger force by sabotage and harassment. I got another email yesterday from a real ass, a first-class leftist fascist ass. With a show like yours, who needs Rush? Really? Do you listen to our show? I agree with the listener who emailed you that you're using the right's language and therefore countermining the left. The word insurgent can only be in effect if the government being resisted is legitimate. Not true. I just read three definitions of the word insurgent. There is no reference to whether or not the government needs to be legitimate or not. Since our occupying force is not legitimate, they are not insurgents but freedom fighters. That is, if you think that a freedom fighter's tactic is using a retarded kid to blow people up, not just people, to blow the same people of their same country up. So they're blowing up their own people with retarded children that don't know better. Okay, so that's what a freedom fighter does. But this guy hates the United States so much, which, you know, is his he can. That's all right.
He's as right as an American.
Yeah, but, you know, let's just understand something. They're using retarded kids as bombs. The freedom fighters that you're glorifying with your mythic language. Okay, so here's the hook, though. Okay, the Down syndrome example you used was disingenuous. Was it really disingenuous? I don't see how it would be disingenuous. They used a retarded kid to blow people up, their own people, the freedom fighters, which means, okay, anyways, you should have said the Iraqi freedom fighters are willing to sacrifice themselves and their children, even a child with Down syndrome, to show the world that death is better than being occupied. Think about it. It's the context, you idiot, not the word. And your context is still trapped in right-wing worldview. Is it really a right-wing worldview to say that somebody who says, hey, retarded kid, come here and put this bomb on and go over to where those people are. Yeah, it's okay if they're your family. Go over there and blow them up. Come on. No, they have candy. Just run over there. Run fast. Fast. Now, is that using the right's language, or are we just talking about human decency, you ass. I mean, yeah, really? Let's look up Freedom Fighter. This is a good one. Freedom Fighter. Here we go. A person who takes part in an armed rebellion against the constituted authority, especially in the hope of improving conditions. All right, so does the jihadist who says, hey, come here, retarded boy, does the jihadist who says that, you really think that he's got a better vision for Iraq? Come here, retarded boy. I know you don't understand the Quran. I know you don't understand what we're doing here, but look at this. It's fun. Here, put this on. This is fun, retarded boy. Now go over there and get the candy from the people. The guy who said that have a better plan for Iraq, you moron, you ass. And then here's the funny thing. At the end of his email, he says, and your context is still trapped in right-wing worldview, it's back to Stern for me. I get what it is. You just want to see retarded people made fun of anyway. You don't care if retarded people die or they voluntarily lose their dignity on Howard Stern. So your problem is with retarded people, you arrogant, hateful turd. Come here. Hey, come here, little boy. Oh, he's retarded. I don't care. Put the bomb on him. Run over there. Get the candy. God bless the freedom fighters. Right, Riley?
Well, look, this guy is insulting genuine freedom fighters throughout history by trying to equate what's going on in terms of beheadings, using children as suicide bombers, and generally oppressing the Iraqi people in much the same way Saddam Hussein did. They have killed too many innocents to be called freedom fighters, folks.
Misplaced hatred of the United States. And I understand it. There's one thing to be critical, but it's another thing to be stupid. Hope you have fun at Stern.
We'll be back with the Liberal Confessional. This is Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition, delivering you from evil. In 3 hours or less, Air America Radio.
We're back. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Yes, it is.
It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. We are hosting Randy Rhodes' show today, Mark Riley.
I'm into it.
That's why we're not here, Mark Riley.
That's absolutely true.
Every week on Tuesday, we take a trip to the Liberal Confessional to unburden ourselves from the liberal guilt we all bear. Our listeners can call in and receive their penance as well. We've got a batch of some of our favorite sinners right now, right here. As always, we'll start with one of the biggest sinners of all. Me.
Bless me, Brother Riley, for I have sinned.
How can I ease your burden, my son?
Well, Brother Riley, it would appear that I have been insensitive to the feelings of people with mental disabilities, though not as insensitive as the freedom fighters who strapped a bomb to a kid with Down syndrome.
I should hope not.
No, of course not. Hell, it's not even the mentally ill per se that I'm accused of being insensitive to. It's their friends, Riley.
And who would these people be?
Teddy bears, Mark. Teddy bears.
Say what? Teddy bear?
Yeah. But the teddy bears don't seem to have a problem with me, and neither do their mentally ill friends. It's friends of the mentally ill who are friends with the teddy bears that seem to be in an uproar. Does that make any sense, Riley?
I am relieved to say it does
not. All right, let me clear it up. Look, as we discussed yesterday, a company put out these crazy-for-you teddy bears that were in straitjackets and had commitment papers, all right? Little goofy commitment papers. And since I don't really have a problem with it, some folks think that I would approve of any kind of sick novelty item, a self-mutilating Barbie or a G.I. Joe with post-traumatic stress syndrome, a Smurf serial killer, you name it.
Well, Brother Mark, would you approve of such things?
Well, yeah, it would depend on the joke. Yeah, and the context. You know, there'd be so much less pain in the world of political correctness if folks would just be more aware of context.
Amen to that. I have a light penance for you this week, my son. I want you to hug a teddy bear.
All right, well, that's not so bad.
In public!
Oh, man, that's harsh.
Now go forth and sin no more.
With my teddy bear, yeah. Well, Brother Riley, thanks for easing my burdens. If anyone else out there wants to confess and seek absolution in our liberal confessional, you can give us a call right now.
Amen.
That was nice. All right. Michael, listening to LIB in Brooklyn, what's your sin, my friend?
Oh, what can I tell you, Mark? This is the deal. I'm feeling pretty guilty about the fact that We now have some on 20% of the world's known oil reserves, and I'm feeling pretty good about that, especially after going through that oil embargo when those sheikhs just pulled the plug on us. I'm feeling pretty bad that George is not going to pull us off. 50 years from now, he's going to look like a hero.
So you feel bad for enjoying the fact that we've got most of the oil under our thumb. Yet have those prices come down at all, Mike?
Last night it went from $2.02
to $1.99.
So, ooh, wow, 2 cents a gallon savings.
So they may have all the oil, but they're still kind of screwing us, aren't they, Mike?
Well, at least it's flowing, Mark.
Yeah, but Mike, remember during the last couple of years of Bill Clinton, what was the price of a gallon of gas? About 75 cents.
Yeah, that's true. But we're not there now. We're here now.
I know.
Okay,
but,
here's your penance, Mike. You have to go to the most expensive gas station and fill your car up for a week and then really think about the benefits of having all the oil.
Oh, my goodness.
All right, take care, Mike. Oh, my goodness.
He went for it.
Anyway, Stephanie, who was sitting in Madison, Wisconsin, on the mic. What's up, Stephanie? What's your sin?
I have sinned. It has been aeons, aeons, aeons since my last confession.
Okay.
Ooh. Oh, I watch trash TV and listen to some sexist, trashy radio, not trashy, but really funny radio, 5 times this week, this last week. I watched The Bachelorette.
Ooh.
And I watched The Apprentice.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoyed them. And I listened to Bob and Tom, my sometimes listen to, and they had some real sexist stuff, and I was laughing at it.
Yeah. Sometimes that's funny. What are you going to do? Bob and Tom are funny guys.
They are funny guys. They are really funny. It's really funny stuff.
Okay, all right. Take it easy.
Don't hype the competition too much here.
I get it. They're really funny. I understand.
Yeah.
Hey, it took me away from
public
radio and from Air America and from public TV and, all that high minded
stuff. What are they on out there? Are they on at the same time we are?
Yeah, they started at 5. I think it's 5:30, yeah.
So you were listening to them other than us?
For a little bit, yeah, then I flipped you guys on.
Wow, now I'm
Mark and Mark are on.
I'm hurt, man.
Yeah, me too.
Well, what you got to do? I have to tell you something. Bob and Tom, I've done that show. Those guys are good guys. So I need you, the first part of your penance is to shoot them an email and say how much you love Mark Maron and Mark Riley in the morning.
Okay.
And that, that you go back and forth between our shows, but tell them to watch their backs because Maron's funny. All right. Can you do that?
I can do that.
All right, here's the other one. Do you like sports?
I do.
Okay. Well, then here's what you're going to have to do for the next week. For a week, you need to watch. I want you to watch reality television. I just want it to be C-SPAN. And I want you to watch maybe 2-3 hours a day of C-SPAN.
Oh, no.
And I'm sad to say that you're going to have to also listen to NPR in the morning for 4 days.
Oh, no. I love NPR. I've always been a public radio junkie, but after listening to you guys and listening to Air America, it's hard for me to go back.
Well, then that doesn't sound like penance. You know what? You're just going to have to put your radio in between stations and listen to that for 3 hours.
Yeah, right.
All right, Stephanie. Bye.
Thank you, Stephanie.
All right, Chris in Connecticut. What's going on?
What's up, Chris?
I've been living with a terrible burden for 20 years.
Oh, my God. Uh-oh. That's deep.
When I lived in New York 20 years ago and was working the polls at the 1984 election.
Yeah.
An elderly lady with poor vision couldn't make out the levers in the booth.
Yeah.
She wanted to know which was the lever for Reagan.
Yeah.
And myself and the Republican attendant went into the booth to help her, but it turned out the Republican attendant wasn't Republican, just poor.
No. Okay.
And registered Republican every year for the, I think it was $65 back then.
Oh, wow.
That you get for a day's work.
Yeah.
So it was left for me to pull the lever.
Yeah.
And you pulled it for Fritz Mondale, didn't you?
No, I didn't.
You pulled it for Reagan?
That's where the burden comes in. Yes, I did the right thing.
Oh, she just would have put Fritz over the top.
So you're actually, you did the right thing, and you feel bad for doing the right thing.
Oh, I felt terrible for 20 years.
Well, I guess you can rest reassured that it probably wasn't that vote that put him over the top. But, I guess, you know what? You're going to have to go out and do a bad thing for an old person. there's only one way to counteract this, Chris.
Yeah.
It's going to probably be more painful than the actual action you took the first time.
Yep.
Take it easy. Thanks for calling, Chris.
Man.
Well, Riley, I feel like we did a good thing there.
Yeah.
Remember, if you're being crushed by liberal guilt, you can stop by the Liberal Confessional every Tuesday on Morning Sedition. When we come back, we'll take a trip to Planet Bush and hear Mike Doty's live in-studio performance. It's 27 past the hour. This is Air America Radio.
You gotta keep them separated.
Hi, this is Reverend Barry Lynn from Americans United for Separation of Church and State, here to remind you that God and politics don't mix. That's why I get my God from the Good Book and my politics from Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Welcome back. 34 past the hour. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Good morning.
This afternoon we'll be hosting Randy Rhodes' show, which is why we're doing this like this, because I'm going to be tired
after
my performance last night, and we wanted to introduce ourselves to a whole new world of Randy Rhodes fans.
Yes.
Right now you're hearing the percussive guitar of Mike Doty, one of our favorite guests on Morning Sedition. He stopped by the day after the State of the Union address to play a few tunes, so let's have a listen. That is Mike Doty, who will be with us momentarily. It's 34 past the hour. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Yep.
You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. And after listening to the State of the Union speech last night and watching some of the coverage of it, I felt like I had entered an alternate reality, if you know what I'm talking about. Well, here at Morning Sedition, we are at the cutting edge of alternate reality, thanks mainly to our Planet Bush correspondent, Lawton Smalls, who joins us now. Lawton, what did you think of the speech, Lawton?
Mark, God's talking. Get on your feet.
Oh.
Well, like everyone else, I was deeply moved by the incredibly emotional sight I saw in the audience last night.
I assume you're talking about the moment near the end when the mother of the fallen American soldier hugged that Iraqi woman who had voted in Sunday's election. Is that what you're talking about?
Huh, I missed that. I was in the commode. I had to tickle something fierce. You know? No. What I was talking about is the sight of all those Republican senators holding up their fingers with the purple ink. Goosebumps, Mark.
Yeah, but those senators, they didn't vote in the Iraqi election. They weren't even close to being in harm's way, my friend.
But it took incredible courage for them to stick their fingers in purple ink.
Oh,
you know how hard that is to wash off?
Oh, no.
If they cut their finger, they could have gotten blood poisoning.
Oh.
And yet, they had the guts to smudge their fingers anyway. That vision, leadership, goosebumps.
All right, dude. What do you think about the actual speech?
Well, Mark, I don't know if you're into the high-tech gadgetry at all, kind of like me, but I sent you a recording of some of my favorite moments from the speech on something called a video cassette tape.
Yeah, I've heard of that. Yeah.
It's new. All right? Okay. Could we play the first clip?
For example, in the year 2027, the government will somehow have to come up with an extra $200 billion to keep the system afloat. And by 2033, the annual shortfall would be more than $300 billion. By the year 2042, the entire system would be exhausted and bankrupt.
Do you hear what they're saying?
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
They're saying, "You're right, President Bush."
No.
We're wrong.
No.
We're wrong. It was like being in church. The spirit had moved them.
You can't deny that.
Lawton,
it was actually a very divisive moment, mainly because what the president said was patently false, my friend.
All right. Hang on.
What?
I got another clip. Play the other clip.
Come on.
For the good of families, children, and society, I support a constitutional amendment to protect the institution of marriage.
Oh, Mark, I have never heard an attack on the wicked lifestyle of godless sodomites so beautiful.
Come on. That was completely irrelevant to the issues. Completely irrelevant to the issues that our country's facing, my friend.
Well, all right. Let's have another one here.
Okay.
You know, I think this is the one that will be remembered and quoted for years to come.
What's it?
Okay.
Oh, Lawton's been a bad neoconservative.
What is that?
Oh, Lawton loves the taste of it.
What, Lawton?
Why are you stopping? Why are you stopping?
What is that? What was that?
That was me being whipped by a woman in a corset.
What? How'd that get on the...
I'm fine with that.
Lawton, is this...
I'm completely relaxed.
Is there something you want to tell us about? You got some other side that you're hiding?
What? 2042! The whole Social Security system is going bankrupt by 2042! You don't care about that! We all have needs.
Hey, Lawton, buddy.
Need.
It's okay, man. I totally believe that it's
We're not going to get our needs met.
I completely believe it's Social Security that sent you out of shape, okay, as opposed to any deep-seated emotional problems, maybe. Yeah, I know. I get it. You can be all right, buddy. It's nice to know that. Yeah?
Now, tell me about the part of the speech I missed. Two women were hugging, really? That's not right. Did you have tape of that?
No.
I have a VCR. I'd really like to check that out.
It's a whole new sighting. I'm hanging up now.
Send me a JPEG.
A JPEG. She knows JPEG. All right, buddy. All right. That was kind of creepy to know that part of Lawton.
Right now.
In our studio, musician, former frontman for the band Soul Coughing, now a newly signed at ATO Records, right?
Yep, that's right. Yep.
They've also re-released his early album, Skittish and Rockety Roll, that just came out in two CDs in one package.
Word.
And now you're here, and you've been everywhere.
Here I am. I've been everywhere.
Mark.
Yes.
You forgot his name.
Oh, Mike Doty. Mike Doty.
I'm some dude. I've been everywhere.
This guy with the guitars here. I got this list of things he did.
That's all right. I'm a little freaked out from looking at Dennis Hassert's big weird face.
Isn't that weird? You just see two big weird faces. He's like stereo Satan.
Oh, God.
You got Hassert and Cheney on either side.
He's kind of like the hayseed baby version of Dick Cheney, really.
Weird. And Cheney's just sitting there, like, you know, munching on the bones of unborn children.
Oh, my God, he's so evil looking.
Yeah, he is.
It's incredible.
And you know, all of it's his idea. It's watching George Bush talk is almost like him watching, like, going, my penis is talking. That's my heart that doesn't work. It's up there talking.
Oh, Mike, you know he's going straight to hell.
Yeah, I again? Know.
I'm not talking about Cheney. I'm talking about him.
Mm-hmm. Again?
Mm-hmm. Again.
Mike's been to hell. We met there. So where have you been, man?
Oh, I've been, well, I went to Ethiopia in August.
Oh, wow.
For the hell of it. Past few years, I've been, made a deal with myself. I go someplace weird once a year for a few weeks.
But what drove you to Ethiopia? I mean, what part of your heart said?
I don't know, man. Well, I was hearing all these weird Ethiopian pop records from the early 70s.
Okay.
Basically, I go to places with weird alphabets.
Okay.
Cambodia, weird alphabet.
Yeah. Like when you see the menus from restaurants in the language.
Yeah, exactly.
I need to know
more about that. More or less. Yeah. So, you know, I went for like 3 weeks and sort of went all around the country. It was really cool.
What'd you see? What moved you? What got you going over there?
Well, I heard some really odd music. I went to this club where they have these sort of Ethiopian comedians almost. They play like these two-string guitars, and they just talk smack about people in the audience.
Yeah.
And I was the one white guy in the club, so I just got busted on.
You got a smack?
Yeah, no, and I was with this Ethiopian guy who was, like, translating for me, and apparently he was, like, completely arch, because I'd be like, Lul, what's he saying? Oh, he's saying, you are great, and welcome to Bashar.
And meanwhile, everyone's laughing. I don't think they're saying that, right?
Yeah.
Now, did you take any musical influences? I mean, were you moved by the, yourself a two-string guitar?
No, I couldn't find one. But
really, did you look
that? But it was badass, the music on that.
Uh-huh.
It was so good.
Like, what's it comparable to? Is it what kind of music? Or what's the sound?
Well, you know, I think in the end it all sounds like the blues. You know?
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah.
So is it sort of Senegalese? Have you heard Ethiopian pop?
Yeah. It's not. I don't think it's as Senegalese influenced as it is in part. And this is really strange because, you know, the relationship between Ethiopia and specifically Eritrea and Italy is such that there's some Italian influence
in
Ethiopian music.
And there's like sort of an Arabic melodic thing going on.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
All right, so I'm going to be looking for that sound in your next album.
Yeah,
exactly. You're going to play a couple songs for us?
Yeah, totally.
Okay, we'll be back with Mike Doty after this. He's going to play some songs, so hang out 42 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Morning Tradition, delivering you from evil in 3 hours or less, Air America Radio.
Upon the rails, among the weeds, I had a moment of serenity.
46 past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Yep.
Sitting here with Mike Doty, the former frontman of Soul Coughing and now newly signed ATO Records Act.
Word.
Re-released his early solo album, Skittish and Rockety Roll, in December, and he's got a deal to do a new one. He's going to play a couple songs. Either one of these from the new record?
I'll do one from Rockety Roll, 27 Jennifers, and I'll do one from the one that's coming out in May.
Okay, cool.
Cool.
Cool. You ready?
Yeah, I'm ready. I'm coming back. I got my headphones turned up.
I went to school with 27 Jennifers. 16 Jens, 10 Jennies, and then there was her. Force of divine love, the blessed arrival of you. You might be the one that I've been seeking for. You might be the strange, delightful. You might be the girly, still and all girls. You might be the sweet, unspiteful. I rode the bus with 27 Jennifers. 16 gents, 10 jennies, and then there was her. Gift from my side, man. Gladness is fly down. The happiness stinks up the room. I've been seeking for. You might be the strange, delightful. You might be the girly, she'll end all girls. You might be the sweet, unspiteful. You might be the one that I've been seeking for. You might be the strange, delightful. You might be the girly, she'll end all girls. You might be the sweet, unspiteful. 27 Jennifers. 27 Jennifers.
Yeah!
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Mike Doty. Great song, wow, man. 27
thanks, man.
Jennifers.
You got it.
I did love that name. I like the one named Jessica, too. What's the next one you were going to
do? I'm going to play a song. I got a record coming out in May called Haughty Melodic.
Okay.
And, song called "Looking at the World from a Bottom of Looking at the World from the Bottom of a Well."
Once again, Mike Doty.
Cool, right on. Here we go.
That Cuban girl that brought me low, she had that skin so fine, her red lips rose like now. Her mouth was white, sweet as well. Now and then, less hours of dreaming of her smell. And I feel as if I am looking at the world from the bottom of a well. And I feel as if I am looking at the world from the bottom of a well. And lonely, and the only way to beat it is to bat it down. And the only way to beat it is to bat it down. And the only way to beat it is to bat it down. Lonely, and the only way to beat it is to bat it down. And the only way to beat it is to bat it down. And the only way to beat it is to bat it down. For all the days that I have run, I sought to lose that cloud that's blacking out the sun. My train will come, so one day soon. Then when it comes, I'll ride bound from night to noon. I feel as if I am looking at the world from the bottom of a well. And I feel as if I am looking at the world from the bottom of a well. And aimless days, uncool ways of being affected. Painless days, blacked out thoughts you be rejected. Lonely, and the only way to beat it is to bat it down. And the only way to beat it is to bat it down. And the only way to beat it is to bat it down. Lonely, and the only way to beat it is to bat it down. And the only way to beat it is to bat it down. And the only way to beat it is to bat it down. But let's get down to business now. I feel as as if I am looking at the world from the bottom of a well. And I feel as if I am looking at the world from the bottom of a well. And I feel as if I am looking at the world from the bottom of a well. And I feel as if I am looking at the world from the bottom of a well.
Wow, that's great, man, guys.
So, Mike, we could talk. We got time for one more song. You want to play one more?
Yeah, totally.
You
play one more.
Yeah.
It's White Lexus from Haughty Melodic.
Groovy.
Please show me how to live. Please show me how to have a day. Up now. Why do I have to wake up anyway? Like a soap star in anguish, Wilbur Bland. When your white Lexus comes around the way, I lay in the long driveway, try to feel nothing on command. When your white Lexus comes, the thrill be damned. I'll forgive the world right now. Still, I bet the chumps roll every time. My world's the surface of the moon. My heart's down in a diamond mine. Like the black stars of Memphis moaning on. When your white Lexus comes to drive me out, drive me to the edge of town, try to feel nothing on command. When your white Lexus comes, the thrill be damned. Damn it to the last damn man. When your white Lexus comes, when your white Lexus comes, when your white Lexus comes.
Yeah!
Thanks, Mike Doty, really ladies and gentlemen.
Sorry, I threw out the request line over there. Anyway.
That's all right.
Do I have time for one quick question?
Yeah.
Mike, you use your guitar much, there's a percussive sound to your guitar playing.
I assume it's
deliberate.
Yeah, I'm trying to be a drummer, you know. I mean, basically.
I used to be. That's how I could tell real quick.
Oh, yeah.
Where does it come from?
Well, it comes from trying to sound like hip-hop records from 1991 when you're sitting around as a 21-year-old kid playing an acoustic guitar, you know?
Yeah.
Going on a sampler.
But it's also pretty interesting, though, because that when you put the capo on, up like four frets, and you do hit it, and you pick like that, it does have that weird Senegalese kind of touch.
Totally.
It kind of has that ping, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That you hear a lot of. The new record's coming out in May, and those last two songs were from the new record?
Last two were.
And the first two solos, Skittish and Rockety Roll, are now available in one package from ATO Records, your new recording company. It was great seeing you.
Oh, thanks for having me, man.
Thanks for coming. Always great to have you.
Mike Doty sounds so great, you know? It's just like, it's just an acoustic guitar, and I was looking at his the liner notes for a CD. Like, that was his dream. You know, he was in a band that used a lot of different musical textures, but he always just wanted to do the acoustic guitar thing.
And a very percussive acoustic guitar. He's an amazing performer. I actually got the CD, the Rockety Roll, and the other one, and then I went and got the Future soundtrack of America, because I wanted to hear the difference between the Move On he did on that and the Move On that he did on the other CD. And, of course, he did that acoustically for us once before when he was a great piece of music.
Very engaging. Engaging performer. And he's one of these guys that I met years ago. He was dating a friend of mine. And, like, I had a soul coughing record, but I never really locked into it, you know. And he was a fan of mine, and we were sort of friendly. Like, I knew him, but it was one of those scenes like, you know, I can't really say anything about your stuff. I don't really know your stuff. So I'm just, you know, it was one of those great revelations when he played. And I was like, oh, my God, thank God he's great.
Yeah, he's a bard, too. I mean, he really, I love his lyrics. He has some depth and texture to what he says.
Absolutely. So we'll be back. We got Terry Jones from Monty Python coming up, and also all our best comedy. It's 57 past the hour. This is Air America Radio.
Morning's Edition is more than just a commute companion. Listen online at morningsedition.com. Morning's Edition, on the air. Online. Listen at the office at morningsedition.com.
Welcome back. How are you? It's 6 past the hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
The show is Morning Sedition here on Air America Radio. Mark and I are hosting Randy Rhodes' show this afternoon. Randy, as most of you know, is recovering from some surgery. We hear she's doing fine, and we're thrilled to be helping her out with this.
The great Randita.
I
love
up?
Her show. Yeah, man. I mean, she is did the she queen of radio.
Did she call herself that, or did she just make
no,
that
I
up?
No, I just made that up.
Great Randita. There you go. I hope you're listening, Randy, because you've just been deemed the great Randita by Mark Riley. So we're going to hear our interview now with the founding member of Monty Python, Terry Jones. We talked to him about Iraq, the South Asian tsunami, 9/11. It might seem like weird things to talk about with one of Python's you know, great funny men, but you'll hear why we did, and you'll also hear today's Palm Pilot courtesy of Ramon.
Now, Armstrong Williams is obviously not a member of the cabinet, but somebody clearly willing to do the bidding of the
money.
Of the RNC.
Private dancer.
Here's his Palm Pilot for today. 7 a.m. Wake up. Zippity-doo-dah. Oh, my, what a wonderful day.
Oh, this is going straight to the tank here.
7:30 a.m. 7:30 a.m. Breakfast. Good morning, Aunt Jemima.
Oh,
my special lady. Here we go. 8 a.m. Take car service to work. Tell driver to avoid Martin Luther King Boulevard. 10 a.m. on NPR, defend Bush's handling of the war in Iraq. 4 minutes. Bill RNC, $5,000. 11 a.m. in elevator, casually mention enthusiasm for Bush's Social Security policy. 2 minutes. Bill RNC, $3,000. 1 p.m. lecture to black journalism students. Title, Get Paid by Any Means Necessary. 3 p.m. Watch BET. Notes, these people have such interesting slang. 9 p.m. Order Chinese food. Extol the virtues of tort reform to delivery guy. Bill RNC, $200.
Zippity doo dah, okay. Aunt Jemima. Boy, this is going to be a wonderful day here.
Oh, man. Okay, here we go. Now, I'm excited because, you know, I grew up watching, you know, Monty Python, the
yeah.
show, you know, late at night on PBS when it ran when I was a kid. And Terry Jones is one of the original Pythons. He's got a book out. It's Terry Jones's War on the War on Terror, a founding Python seriously funny ruminations on the post 9/11 world. That's available at our website. He writes columns targeting the Anglo-American response to September 11, 2001. He has a weekly column, I believe. And he also, of course, has been in the Monty Python and the Holy Grail and the Meaning of Life and the Life of Brian, which he also directed. It's I'm thrilled to have you here. Good morning, Terry Jones.
Hi, Mark.
How you doing, Terry?
Very good.
So in your new column, I guess this is dated January 11th, you talk about how you are really bewildered by the world's response to the tsunami tragedy in terms of the amount of money that people are willing to divvy up to help out, and you have a very specific reason for that.
Well, yeah, no, I mean, I'm not complaining. I think it's wonderful
sure.
people are divvying out all this money to help the victims of the tsunami. It's just what occurred to me was that it's something like 150,000 people have died in the tsunami wave. where 150,000 Iraqis have died in Iraq because of what the UK and US have done there.
Mm-hmm.
They've died from bombing and strafing and all that kind of stuff. It's probably around 150,000. The Lancet article said there was 100,000 at least.
Right.
It's the same amount of human. It's a human catastrophe on the same scale of the tsunami disaster.
Yes.
And yet nobody's sort of raising money to help the dead Iraqis.
I think that they've decided that the killing hasn't stopped yet, and they want to get the numbers right.
They want to get the numbers right. You're probably absolutely
right. But Terry, the thing is, don't the Bush administration and the Blair administration have a vested interest in keeping more or less secret from their various publics, the numbers of people who have actually died? I mean, we don't really, other than this Bloomberg School of Public Health study from Johns Hopkins, there's been no hard and fast estimate. Don't you think that's deliberate?
Well, I think it is. I mean, it's deliberate that they're not doing body counts. So, for one of the first times, nobody's recording how many victims or how many people die. And in fact, as far as we understand, the American military and the British military too, probably for one, are actually when they went into Fallujah for the second time, they were actually taking steps to actually stop people counting the bodies. For example, they were attacking clerics and doctors and wiping out hospitals, because it's in the hospitals where they do the body counts, of course. So they were actually actively taking action to stop anybody counting the bodies.
So what kind of reaction are you getting with your columns over there? Are people doing the standard thing they do with people who have a reputation for being funny, just saying like, oh, that's not very witty?
Well, I don't know. I sort of get different reactions, really. I mean, sometimes there was one column I did which sort of became the thing everybody was sending on their internet thing. It was the thing about my neighbors and not liking my neighbors and sort of doing exactly the same reactions that Bush and Blair are doing in world politics and applying that to the politics of the street. And it just suddenly looks ridiculous. You know, if you've got suspicions about, you don't really know, but you don't like the way he's looking at you, so I'm going to bomb him, you know.
Terry, I was just over in England for 2 weeks and got back just after New Year's, and one of the things that struck me was what I perceived to be a simmering anti-Americanism among many of the people that I talked to over there, including members of my wife's own family, for that.
Really?
How widespread is that, or is that just an anecdote?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I hope it's not anti-Americanism. I think there's a lot of anti-Bushism and a lot of anti the present American regime. But I hope it's not being confused with anti-Americanism.
So are you saying that you like us, Terry?
Yeah.
Oh, I think you're lovely.
Oh,
okay. Especially you, Mark. I'm not sure about the other Mark. Mark, you're wonderful.
Thank you.
Gee, thanks. I'm surprised you were able to parse that quick. Terry, George W. Bush, despite the war in Iraq, won re-election here. Blair is up this year, right, in May?
It's going to be interesting to see what happens.
Is going to happen? Again, talking to people, I got a sense that they had problems with him, but they were resigned to the fact he'd get re-elected because his opposition is so fragmented.
Yeah, I mean, there's no opposition. I don't know who you vote for. I mean, really, there's no one to vote for here. I mean, it's democracy becomes a joke when you don't have anyone to vote for. What's the point of having democracy? You know, there's no difference. Blair has become more Thatcher than Thatcher. And
really?
You're stuck. They spent all this time, the Labour Party spent all this time stopping what they called entryism when they thought the left wing was taking over the Labour Party. I thought the Labour Party was a left wing party, but anyway. then now it's been taken over by, a covert Thatcher supporter, basically.
I just love the fact that in Parliament, when I watch it on television here on C-SPAN or whenever I see it, I like that there's actually debate and yelling and people booing and stuff. That's tremendous. Everyone's afraid to talk in our Senate.
Yeah, right? They try to be courtly. Terry, I don't want to do too much inside stuff here, but how bad is this rift between Blair and his Chancellor of the Exchequer, Gordon Brown?
I don't really know. I mean, the papers are making a lot of noise about it, but I haven't any idea really about what's going on there. I mean, although Brown was supposed to always be sort of the heir in waiting to take over the throne kind of thing. But I mean, Blair looks so ill. I mean, I can't imagine. And he must be racked with guilt. I mean, I can't imagine anybody being able to carry on knowing what he's responsible for, That he's put his country, he's put England on the front line for terrorist attack. He says he's saving us from terrorism. Of course, they're doing absolutely the opposite thing. I mean, I think that's really why I started writing the columns, because it seemed to me that after 9/11, our great leaders, every single action they took seem to be designed to have the opposite effect from the one they said they were going to do.
Well, they wanted to design a new sort of a pseudo-Cold War situation where the element of fear would be spread throughout the world and they can control the people better.
Well, I think that's probably true. I mean, I don't know whether your listeners know about the project for the new American century.
Oh, of course. Of course. You know what, Terry, can we hold you a few more minutes over the break? We hear you're sitting with somebody that might want to pipe in. So, and we'll talk a little bit about the book and continue this conversation with Terry Jones, one of the founding members of Monty Python. After this, it's 42 past the hour on Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning Sedition, the highest rated, most respected news show in America. On Air America Radio.
Seven past the hour. We're back. It's our morning sedition with Mark Riley and Mark Maron. You're listening to Air America Radio on the phone. One of the founding members of Monty Python, Terry Jones, also the author of Terry Jones's War on the War on Terror, a founding Python series with funny ruminations on the post 9/11 world. That's available at morningsedition.com for a slight discount. Terry, we were talking about Tony Blair looking awfully exhausted and drained, and because of maybe perhaps he's consumed by guilt. Maybe he's not using his religion properly. Our president seems to have no conscience whatsoever because he's so entrenched in Christianity.
No, I think that's right. I think Bush is actually a perfect front for the people behind him, for the Rumsfelds and Cheneys and Pearls, and because he absolutely believes in what he's doing, and he's probably a very nice chap, you know. But it's just this thing about them doing exactly the wrong thing. I mean, for example, after 9/11, I thought George Bush said exactly the right thing. He said, "We've got to find the evil perpetrators of this evil crime." Absolutely right. Except that I would have thought if you're going to catch some evil perpetrators of evil crimes, you need secrecy, you need speed, and you need to get them taken by surprise. What you don't do is announce where you're going to look for them. We're going to look in Afghanistan. Say, when are you going to do it? We're going to do it in 2 months' time. You know, that 2 months' time. And then you say what you're going to do to them. We're going to bomb you. Right? I mean, by that time, any evil perpetrators would have got out of Afghanistan. I would have done. I mean it's so nonsensical. And as a result, have they caught any of the evil perpetrators? No, of course they haven't.
Well, they say they have some of the top of what they think to be Al-Qaeda people locked up.
Yeah.
If you're running a firm, an industrial firm or something, and you made mistakes like that, saying they've got weapons of mass destruction, or there's a link between Saddam Hussein and Al Qaeda, and you made mistakes on such a scale and committed your company to spending money to do that, you'd be out of a job by now.
Yes.
But here it is: they've spent billions and billions of dollars, killed hundreds of thousands of people, and they're still running the show. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Well, they've made a lot of their friends very, very wealthy.
I think that's what
even more so.
Yes.
So,
absolutely.
Let me ask you a question about how you approached, you know, the topic of religion with the Monty Python group, and specifically in the life of Brian, because, you know, the amazing success of The Passion of Christ, it was sort of daunting. And I just thought a great double feature would be Life of Brian in The Passion of Christ.
Yeah.
Don't you? I mean, when you approach religion, what do you see is sort of, what do you think is the most dangerous about the way religion is being used in the world today?
Well, I think it's the same way it's always been used, quite honestly. I mean, religion has always been a cover for people wielding power. And that goes right back to biblical times. It was true in the 14th century. I've got another book coming out in the States this week called Who Murdered Chaucer. And that's exactly the same thing when you see how the Archbishop of Canterbury uses his religion to actually support the usurper, Henry IV, who illegally usurps the throne of Richard II. And it's the same. People have always used religion as a cover for holding and wielding power. I've got another gentleman here just walked in the room, Terry Gilliam.
Oh, wow. That's
would you
amazing.
Like word with him?
Yeah, yeah, put him on the phone.
Hang on a second.
Okay.
All right. Two for one here.
Yeah.
Hello.
How are you doing?
How are you, Terry Gilliam? It's Mark and Mark here.
Hi.
So, you know, are you guys working on something right now? You got a movie in the works, Terry?
Well, I do. Terry's just using my phone at the moment.
What do you got going? Is it going to be something trippy?
Oh, I've got a film I'm just finishing off now called Tideland, which I kind of described as Alice in Wonderland meets Psycho.
So, yes, definitely trippy.
Yeah.
I'm a huge fan of your work, and I recently watched Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, and I got to be honest with you, if you did any drugs whatsoever in your life, as I have, it makes perfect sense, Terry.
That's great. That's good, because I don't do drugs, and I was hoping that there would be people to confirm my
well,
ideas were correct.
You definitely got the vibe, and I don't know what you how you made Benicio del Toro do whatever the hell he did in that movie, but it was really disturbing and very provocative.
Good.
So how long have you been affiliated with the Pythons, and how did that start?
Oh, that's from way back, from the beginning. The first connection was somewhere around 1963 in New York when I met John Cleese. He mm-hmm. was in New York. With a group called Cambridge Circus, and they were doing a review show in the Village, and I was editing a magazine, and I got him to appear in the magazine in a photo story about a man who falls in love with his daughter's Barbie doll.
Yeah, and the rest is history.
Exactly.
And so you moved to England. You lived there primarily.
Yeah, I mean, I left the States in 67 and have been here ever since.
Really?
Yeah.
What attracted you?
Well, it was a combination of, you know, English humor, the fact that I was living with an English girlfriend, and I became very disillusioned with America in 67 and felt either I'm going to start becoming a full-time radical, a bomb-throwing radical, or I could be a, you know, reasonably happy cartoonist.
That's interesting. Either I destroy the state or make funny things.
That's right.
There you go.
Of dealing with it. There's many ways of attacking the state.
Absolutely.
One of these provides more entertainment for other people.
All right. Well, thanks for talking to us. Is Terry sitting there going, it's my interview. It's mine. Okay. Can I have the phone,
yeah,
please?
He wants to tell you everything.
Ah, there you go.
Well, nice talking to you, Terry.
Thanks, Terry.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hi there.
Hey, Terry.
Were you getting mad?
Now, this is Terry Jones. For the audience that's just tuning in, this is Terry Jones we're talking to now. We just got finished talking to Terry Gilliam.
Is Terry Gilliam sitting there? What? You said you gave me the phone.
I just walked in. I'm actually just doing a commentary on a Peston Sturges film, Sullivan's Travels, in about 10 minutes, right?
Oh, really?
5 minutes time. And I came to Goldcrest, and they said, oh, Terry Gilliam's upstairs. So I didn't even realize he was here.
You know, I read this article about you guys, all the remaining Pythons were discussing, Eric Idle's new musical. And there's an article in New York Times, or in the New York Magazine, I think.
Oh, yeah, New Yorker, yeah.
The New Yorker, I called everyone, we had a conference call, you organized a conference call, and everyone said, well, sounds good. And I thought to myself, I would just like to hear you guys just talking seriously on the phone at the same time. it was unlike any show business story I'd ever read before, where there's usually cutthroat battles, but you guys are all friends, huh?
Yeah, I guess we are. I mean, Terry's let me use his office, so he's not.
Well, that was Terry Jones, and like out of nowhere, Terry Gilliam sitting right there. Terry Gilliam, the guy who did Time Bandits, Baron Munchausen, Brazil. That was insane.
Yeah,
I forgot about that.
These guys are—it's amazing to me. They've been tight for all of these years. I mean, remember Monty Python started in the late '60s,
and they're still
hanging out,
just sitting around. And it's so funny to hear Terry Jones, because if you watch Monty Python, they all have such distinct voices. It's like, there he is. All right. Well, look, coming up now, there's a lot of things if you don't listen to the show for all 3 hours that you might miss. Comedy bits, some things, some funny moments that Mark Riley and I had. And we've put some of these together for you just in case you missed them, or just in case you want to hear them again. It's 27 past the hour. This is Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning's Edition on Air America Radio.
Welcome back, 34 past the hour. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Good morning.
It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. This afternoon, hours away, Mark and I are going to be hosting Randy Rhoads' show. Looking forward to that. We're going to hear a bunch of Morning Sedition's best comedy bits now. There's a Dream Diary in here, a Morning Sedition Radio Theater. But to kick it off, with one of our most popular, yes, it's Rapture Watch, with MILF Cardinal Milfington.
You know, the Bible's Book of Revelations pretends the end of days and the second coming of the Christian Messiah, which is one of our president's favorite stories. Though no one knows when the end times will come, there are signs that will appear to men. Here on Morning Sedition, we won't let you be caught off guard by the end of the world. That's why we present this week's Rapture Watch with MILF Cardinal Milfington of the recently disgraced Diocese of Janesville, Wisconsin. Your Grace.
Take notice, that one, Che Tours of God. Shintasa Ushunda Tampa. Heed my heedings, thy toad-eating sons of Stuval, Mozak, Hosea, and Carl. Mandada Ba Kasa Pata Pata. Listen closely, ye owners of Garden of Eden, natural food products. Your name is not only heretical, it's a stupid pun. Jesus doesn't care about 15 varieties of corn chips. He just wants one that won't fall apart in his friggin' clam dip. Christ wanted sea salt and love in his mango salsa. He would have married Dom DeLuise. Shuntapa wubba wubba. Now, you may recall, 3 hebdo modules ago, I told you about a 120-year-old tortoise and a baby hippo becoming inseparable companions at the Nairobi Zoo, where they engaged in all sorts of unnatural tortoise-on-hippo action. The week after that, I spake of a dog in Montana who was snatched up by a bald eagle and then showed up safe 3 days later with his little doggy sweater on backwards. And the week after that, I told you how Fox's Who's Your Daddy got the lowest ratings in its time slot. What in the name of our holy Savior is the matter with you people? Can't stand the sight of a middle-aged bald guy wearing a man girdle? That show could have been my big break. Anyway, if you're like me, you probably just heard about that big earthquake in South Asia that did all that damage and stuff. But did you also know that it caused the planet to wobble off its axis, permanently accelerating Earth's rotation, thereby shortening the length of the average day? So saith the learned scientists at NASA, which, according to my research, stands for Nerds Admiring Satan's Anus. Either that or the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. But I'm going with Nerds Admiring Satan's Anus myself. Little catch here. What does all this mean, you habitudinous rubbers of smooth skin parts? Well, Jesus is coming sooner than we thought. In a shorter day means less time I have to wait to be raptured up to heaven, where I'll sit at the throne of Jesus and his pet monkey, Nibbles. For it was prophesied in Revelation 16 tons, and what do you get? And I quote, and 1/3 of everything was destroyed, and every mountain and island was moved out of its place, causing days to become shorter, and Republicans to reduce the minimum wage. End quote. And so your destruction draweth nigh, sinners. So nigh, it's nigher than nigh. In fact, it's not even nigh anymore. It's like 1/8 nigh, or... Tsunamis, mass death, it's all part of God's great plan to get here faster. Of course, if he really wanted to arrive sooner, I suppose he could just, you know, arrive sooner. But anyway, who am I to complain? It's all good, all good. I'm with it, yeah. Don't want to second guess our leader. Way to go, Jesus. So until next time, if there is a next time, keep on fornicating, fornicators, and we'll keep a light on for you. In hell.
Now, what is that, Cardinal? Is that speaking in tongues?
Or? I'm channeling the word of God in another language that is you cannot decipher it. Because you are not one of the... Pray with me, Mark.
Well, okay.
Pray with me. We're going to pray on the streets. We'll pray in the toilets.
Okay.
I'm going to run you ragged, boy.
We know things are tough in the job market, so we decided to help out. We read the news about Bush exploring the Salvador option in Iraq using assassination and kidnapping squads, and then we scanned through the Sunday Help Wanted listings and found this for our morning's edition Monday job listing.
My home.
exciting and fun opportunities in death squads. The Bush administration is hiring. That's right. As part of our continuing effort to win the hearts and minds of the Iraqi people, we in the Bush administration are instituting a program of murder and torture, or should we say a more properly organized program of murder and torture. We're creating death squads. Successful applicants for these posts will be responsible for intimidating Iraqis not to support the insurgency. You will be given the Iraqi people an alternative to the rebels, and that alternative is to be kicked to death by you and your new co-workers. Death squads, or action teams as we're calling them, are the perfect place for people who like to kill people but dislike the burdens of a military lifestyle. Who says you have to wake up at 5 a.m. and do push-ups just because you enjoy strangling people with barbed wire? So if your idea of fun is raping an Iraqi grandmother while forcing the whole family to watch, give us a call. But please, no weirdos.
And now, the Morning Tradition Radio Theater Company players bring you their production of The Shadow Government.
Deep in Washington, D.C., lives a group that has the ability to cloud citizens' minds. What evil lurks in the heart of the shadow government? Mark Maron knows. When we last left our hero, his search for Colin Powell had led him to a New York strip club called the Velvet Peanut. He was looking for a lady with a snake.
Hey, baby. Want to dance?
Sorry, doll. I'm working a case. I'm a private dick.
You and every other guy who comes in here. Except you're a little more private.
I thought you worked with a snake.
I do. He's my boss, and he's waiting for you in the back room.
Well, 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 look whose luck just ran out.
It was the torture master himself, Alberta Torquemada Gonzalez, with three of his goons. And they were looking at me the way Laura Bush would look at Harvey Firestein. And that ain't pretty, no matter which way you're facing. Surprised to see you here, Gonzalez. Guess I didn't get the memo.
Keep cracking wise, Seamus. I'm about to get Abel Grabe on your ass. Grab him, boys.
Hey, wait, guy. They worked me over like I was Cat Stevens going through airport security. When I came to, I was strapped to a chair, tied up worse than a universal health care bill in committee. And Gonzalez was coming toward me with a bullwhip.
You're gonna tell me what you know about Powell, but I only know one way to ask.
I knew Gonzalez was just trying to rattle me, but he was gone. Wacko, playing with half a deck. He was zeroing in on me like a senior citizen on a bottle of Canadian blood pressure pills.
Is this the champagne room?
It was my pal Bill Clinton with a friend. Hey, Bubba, get me out of here.
Hey, buddy. Gonzalez, now I know what's going on here. Let him go.
You want him? Come and get him.
You know, my doctor said I should avoid spicy foods, but I'm in the mood for a little Mexican.
Oh, great. The squeaky little lawyer from Houston versus the 58-year-old former president with a heart condition. These guys had less muscle than a Guantanamo prisoner on a hunger strike.
You hit like a girl, Clinton.
That was a girl. This is Mindy. I met her at the bar. This is me.
Gonzalez went down like Bush's job numbers.
You all right, buddy?
Yeah. Just help me get untied. I looked around. Gonzalez had vanished quicker than mainstream news coverage of the Iraq War. I gotta light out of here, Bubba, and find Colin Powell.
Powell, buddy, he's in Washington, hawking his resume like Rumsfeld handed out no-bid contracts to Halliburton.
New York was a bum steer, and Washington was calling my name. But I had one more thing to do.
These dances are on me, buddy. And when you get to Washington, remember what I told you about the inauguration.
Will Mark get to Washington in time to save Colin Powell from the swinging, razor-sharp death trap over the Jefferson Memorial? Have I just given away next week's episode? Can you disregard everything I just said? Find out next time when we hear Mindy say,
I don't care if he is your friend, Bill. That cheap bastard didn't hit me.
That's next week on The Shadow Government. And tune in later as Morning Sedition Radio Theater debuts its very first blaxploitation drama, starring a veteran radio newscaster. Wayne Gilman is News Daddy.
I swear, man. I don't know what you're talking about, man.
You wouldn't be holding out a News Daddy, would you?
No, Daddy. I swear, I got no idea how to get stories online from Newswire when the server goes down.
Then I guess there's only one way you're making deadline. 12 floors down.
My, you're some kind of man.
That's right, brown sugar. And now I'm going to invert your pyramid.
Ooh, what's your name, stranger?
I'm Wayne Gilman.
That's News Daddy. Later on, Morning Sedition Radio Theater.
Okay, stick around. We'll have more of this when we come back, including Mort Mortensen and the Morning Remembrance.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Back, I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Yes, it is.
And we're hosting Randy Rhodes later this afternoon, but right now let's get back into the funny.
We're talking about the Republican National Committee, and then we talked about that earlier, about that they wrote a letter to broadcasters basically threatening them to that if they aired a new ad from MoveOn.org urging people to oppose President Bush's Social Security cuts, the ad shows old people, right, basically working at menial jobs, and here's what it sounds like.
First, someone thought up the working lunch. Then we discovered the working vacation. And now, thanks to George Bush's planned Social Security benefit cuts of up to 46% to pay for private accounts, it won't be long before America introduces the world to the working retirement. Call your representatives today and tell them no, George Bush can't cut Social Security.
Okay, in the letter, the RNC Deputy Counsel Michael Bay says, quote, "This letter places you on notice that the information contained in the above-cited advertisement is false and misleading." Okay, unquote. Why? Because that 46% cut in benefits doesn't apply to current retirees, which he had never claims anyway. So most stations just ignored the RNC letter. One station, though, added a disclaimer which says that the cuts, quote, "impact would vary depending on age," unquote. All right, the RNC wanted much scarier disclaimers, however, and we were able to get some. I don't know if it was Ramon who brought them or where we got them, but we were able to get some, and let's hear the first one if we could, Chris.
Call your representatives today and tell them no, George Bush can't cut Social Security.
Warning, your representative does not actually represent you.
See, that's a little edgy. Yeah. But do we have more? Can we hear another one?
Call your representatives today and tell them no, George Bush can't cut Social Security.
Warning, this message does not concern you if you are already hideously old.
Oh, wow. That's an unkind cut. They're not going to make any friends with that one, I don't think. Yeah, let's hear another one, Kayla.
Call your representatives today and tell them no, George Bush can't cut Social Security.
Believing this ad may cause dry mouth and gas with oily discharge.
Oh, I don't know who they're trying to appeal to. You know what I mean? Let's hear, do we have any more? These are getting kind of interesting.
Call your representatives today and tell them no, George Bush can't cut Social Security.
Side effects may include dying hungry, poor, and alone. Consult your HMO for details.
That one has a little resonance to it.
As the people of the grieving nation come together to mourn, to remember, and finally to find hope, Morning Sedition joins with them to mourn, remember, and find hope as well. And so we bring you the stories of those who have lost their lives, those who inspire us to carry on. Here now is Morning Sedition grief correspondent, Mort Mortensen.
Jay Schulberg, ad agency executive. Jay Schulberg, an advertising executive who created famous slogans for corporate America, including the memorable Got Milk campaign, is dead after years of manipulating people to waste their savings on overpriced crap. Excuse me. A cousin to Bud Schulberg, who wrote the film On the Waterfront, Schulberg had always been an aspiring screenwriter. And until the very end, he never gave up on his dream of finding a producer for his heartfelt story of teen angst, titled, I Can't Believe I Ate the Whole Thing.
Right,
can I have a tissue?
Yeah, I'll get you some tissue.
Yeah, thanks.
There you go, man.
Family members would not reveal the exact cause of death, except to say his last campaign slogan was, Got Gout? My eyes are tearing up. It's windy in here. James Griffin, co-founder of the band Bread.
Oh.
This week, the music world received word that James Griffin, founding member of the soft rock group Bread, is toast. In a statement released today to hopeful fans, Griffin's manager said there was no truth to the rumor he's risen. But I guess that news is pretty stale by now.
Oh, no.
Oh, got something in my eyes. Who's chopping onions? Never one to loaf. Griffin helped form Bread in 1968. And after they released the hits Make It With You and Baby I'ma Want You, Bread was on a roll. Any way you sliced it, Bread was hot. There's a cop button over there. Bread made a lot of dough.
Oh, no.
Oh, is there a cat in here? Griffin had been in good health until last week when doctors labeled his condition as crummy.
Oh, no.
When loved ones discovered his body, witnesses say the former lead singer of Bread was crusty.
Oh, no.
Completely riddled with fungus.
Oh, man.
Nothing could be safe, not even the heels.
Oh.
You bring a ficus plant here?
No, man.
And Mark, you know I'm real sensitive about the pollen stuff. One more paragraph.
Okay, buddy.
Griffin requested his body be interned at the family cemetery, sandwiched in between two graves. Evergreens, flowering plants, very sensitive. A lot of suspended particulates in the air this season, right, Mark?
Yeah, no, it's winter, man.
Yeah.
This is my dream diary from last night. I'm in this all-white secret human cloning lab underneath the Hollywood sign. I'm wearing hospital scrubs and a mask, and I'm walking around with the cloning specialist and his clone. They speak in unison. It's weird.
Mark. We've taken a wad of your stem cells and created some variations on the Mark Maron archetype.
There's a row of glass pens. There's a 6'8" hulking super Mark. There's a blonde, blue-eyed Mark wearing an Argyle cardigan. There's a black Mark in a Kangol hat named Marcus Garvey Maron. An Asian Mark, a Latino Marco, a three-headed Mark. One head was complaining, one was eating, and one was crying. There's a Mark that actually likes the Black Crows. There's a couple of female Marks. Word of advice, don't play hard to get. There's a right-wing Mark who bitterly opposes the development of himself. We get to the glowing orange corridor, and they both say,
"Here's our experimental wing."
There's a half Mark, a half lowland gorilla, which was scary. A half Mark, half ficus plant, which would make Jim Rowe allergic. And a half Mark, half grasshopper, hopping around in his glass pen. I say, can I just get that one that can fill in for me sometimes so I can just sleep and stuff? And the doctors say,
right this way.
We get to a Mark who looks just like me. I say, hey, man, how's it going? I'm the original. He says, you're the original? I'm the original. I said, no, you're in my dream, so I'm the original. He says, no, you're in my dream, so I'm the original. This went on for like 4 hours until the half Mark, half Roland gorilla couldn't take it anymore and crushed us both with his giant knuckles. Wow, my brain is so weird. All right, I woke up and my bed was filled with redundancies. Sometimes when you read the headlines, Riley, it can be tough to figure out just exactly what the mainstream media is saying. So I just bought a brand new iNews 5000 Wi-Fi headline translator. Let's crank this baby up and feed it some headlines. Here we go. From the New York Times, North Korea asserts nuclear weapons program rejects talks. Let's put that in the machine. Yes. Here we go. Experts warn poop approaching fan collision imminent. All right. Here's one about the British royal family from Fox News. Charles to marry Camilla. Here we go. Bizarre House of Windsor breeding experiments continue. All right. From the Los Angeles Times, load of Jamaican yams yields 6 tons of pot. All right. Translation. Load of Jamaican yams yields 6 tons of pot. Whoa, man.
That'll do it for us today, but don't forget, we'll be the guest host of the Randy Rhoads Show this afternoon on Air America Radio.
And join us back here Monday morning live for more of Morning's Edition. This is Air America Radio.
See you later, Riley.
All right, man.
Morning's Edition on Air America Radio.